This is XTP Media.
Eventfire Solutions is proud to support Extended. You can find us at eventfiresolutions.co.uk. Enjoy the programme.
You're listening to Extended. Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 47 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. And joining me today is Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine, the well-travelled Tim Robinson. Tim, how are you?
I'm very well. Hello, everybody.
Good to have you back. And Executive Editor of Global Aviation Resource, Gareth Stringer. How are you, Gareth?
I'm good, Peter. You all right?
Yeah, very good. All your fingers still attached?
Yeah, I've just counted them. They're all there.
Glad to have you back.
I counted them all out and I counted them all back.
For those who didn't know, Gareth had a little incident and nearly cut one of his fingers off. So we're glad to have him back and back on the show. And also joining us today to co-host and talk about his latest book, Into the Black, is international best-selling author Roland White, of course, author of our favourite aviation book, Vulcan 607. Roland, welcome back.
Good, lovely to be back. Thanks very much for having me.
We should probably have you a seat in the studio, really, shouldn't we? What's this? Is this four times now or three or four?
Maybe one more time and I become an ace.
Yeah.
Well, have you shot down a regular presenter?
Yeah, all the time.
Well, Roland, it is great to have you back on the show by popular demand as much as anything else. So we're going to come back to talk about your new project and also to hear a little bit about your thoughts on the spirit of Great Britain as well. First, though, we just want to thank everyone for the support we had in being nominated as a finalist in the Best Podcast Award. Sadly, we didn't win, and congratulations go to Meaningful Money, who did win the award, and certainly that is a podcast to be proud of. So well done to the team there. But a big thank you to everyone for all the support that we got. We particularly also want to thank our show supporters, Tony and Paul Whiting at Eventfire Solutions, for all the support that they have been giving to the programme. They've kindly helped us with some stuff, which hopefully behind the scenes will help improve the quality and the process in delivering the show to you. So thank you very much to Paul and Tony. Also, just before we get into the show, as we run up to our 50th episode, We've decided to take a look at the programme, take on any on board any comments you've had about improving it. And on that basis, we've got a little survey and we'll put some links in the show notes. So if you want to give us a bit of feedback, give us a bit of advice, a bit of guidance on some of the topics you do like, some of the things you don't like, we certainly won't be offended if you do tell us. We've already had some fantastic feedback, so thank you to those who've already completed the survey. But please do help us out. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like. That would be gratefully appreciated. Okay, a busy show as always, along with some news into the black and promoting aerospace. We've got a new X10 top 10 from Tim as well. So let's get started by what's caught our eye in the news. Okay, and as I mentioned, we couldn't leave this season without talking about the Spirit of Great Britain, of course, XH-558. I've seen her fly probably for the last time. I think, Roland, you've seen her just the weekend gone by as well.
Yes, I did.
And Tim and Gareth, have you seen her this season as well?
It's the end of an era, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, I think there's going to be a few, you know, tearful av geeks when it all comes to an end. You know, some of the incredible sort of formations have been put together, you know. Every time you kind of click on Twitter, you see, whoa, there's 7 Spitfires and 4 Hurricanes and a Vulcan all together.
Yeah, there's been some great photos.
There's 2 tornadoes. I mean, you know, talk about saving the best to the last. It's going to be extremely emotional, isn't it?
And there's been a lot of talk about should she carry on, and a lot of criticism of certainly the trust and the supporting companies. I think it's very, very unfair. I mean, we've prolonged the airframe of that aircraft to stretching point now. I think we all have to be grateful, I think, for what we've seen, don't we, Gareth?
Absolutely. I mean, it can't carry on that without the engineering support, which moving forward would be, even if those organisations were still, you know, if they could do it, they would be doing it. There's no question. It's a lot of thought and energy went into making that the correct decision. And if anybody's criticising the trust, maybe they should think about the process that got it to this point, you know, in the first place, you know, the restoration and, you know, and the fundraising and you know, and the incredible support from the British people. There are very, very few aircraft, I believe, that this sort of project would work with. And you know, there's talk of other aircraft which people would like to get flying again. And personally, I think unless somebody comes in, a benefactor, if you like, comes in with the money, I think it's going to struggle, because wonderful, I'm not going to mention any names, but wonderful aircraft though they might be, not every aircraft cuts through to the sort of consciousness of the general public in the way that a Vulcan does, or, you know, a Spitfire, or, you know, it's, and I think we're going to talk about another one in a minute that definitely does. But you know, the process to get here was incredible. The period we've had with the aircraft has been incredible, and the end is proving to be, you know, incredible. We're not quite there yet, but we will be soon enough. And you know, to me, it's just hats off to everybody that's been involved from day one, you know, right up to today. She is a true icon of aviation, and not too many of those, and we've been very, very lucky to see her again.
And Roland, I think you saw her at the weekend.
I did. I hadn't been expecting to. And I mean, first of all, I'd echo everything that's just been said. You know, I think we need to be, you know, incredibly grateful for the extra that we've had from her. I mean, it was sort of beyond, you know, reasonable expectation, really, that the trust would ever pull it off and get her flying again. And, you know, against expectation, they did, and we've enjoyed the best part of a decade of seeing her in the sky. And you know, I thought at the time that they were hoping that she might fly again, that if they ever succeeded in that she'd become, at a stroke, the nation's favorite airplane. And that's exactly what happened. And as you've said earlier, you know, I think there'll be tears in eyes when people see her for the last time, and I certainly found myself running up and down between trees in the village at the weekend, when quite unexpectedly I heard the sound of those Olympus engines. I'd known that she was at Shuttleworth, which isn't that far from us. Looked up and saw that incredible shape flying sort of straight down the path of the road that I was cycling up and down with the two girls, my daughters, you know, they were certainly interested in a kitten that had wandered onto the pavement. I said, forget the kitten. Look, it's the Vulcan, and this is the last time you're going to get to see it. So, yeah, Dad, whatever. I hadn't expected to see her that one last time, and I did my very best to. Make sure that I kind of savoured every last moment of it.
Well, as we say, she hasn't quite made her final flight, but we want to thank everybody at the Trust and all the volunteers around this country and, in fact, abroad as well, who've supported keeping the spirit of Great Britain in the skies. So well done to all of those. Tim, I want to come to you next. You've been away a lot since we last spoke. US, Taiwan, a lot's been going on. Should we start with Taiwan and the aerospace show you went to there? What was that about?
Sure. Well, that was going and covering their version of, I suppose you'd call it kind of Farnborough stroke DSEI. It's an aerospace and defence show. It's in a conference centre. It's very, very small compared to Farnborough or for Paris, Le Bourget. But something in very, very interesting stuff going on there. Interesting stuff in UAVs, in composites, in some guys there building a composite rocket with a hybrid motor. They wheeled out what looked like a Taiwanese equivalent of a Reaper drone, and some interesting visits there to go and see, sort of gain an insight into the aerospace industry in that country as well. You know, one of the most interesting places was an MRO in the south of the island, which had a particularly kind of colourful history as a CIA front. It was basically the engineering arm of Air America, which was the CIA's secret airline in the 60s and 70s, up to all sorts of classified and colourful stuff.
Sounds like another book for you, Roland.
This place, you know, this place was founded by one of the Flying Tigers. General Claire Chenault, it had been there since sort of 1946, dates back to 1946, 47. Now under new ownership. What a interesting and bizarre sort of history. Indeed, one of the hangars there where they were fixing airliners was a Japanese built World War II hangar.
Wow!
Right.
Wow. What a lot of history.
Something in Duxford. So. Really, really, sort of interesting place
lots,
to visit.
Lots of drones out. At that show, wasn't there? There was a lot
of
focus
lots
on
of
UAVs.
Drones,
yeah.
They've got a big consumer. They've got a big kind of consumer electronics. Obviously, huge, big consumer industry there. You know, HTC and all the laptop stuff, graphics cards, and they can't compete directly with people like. Say Honeywell or Rockwell Collins in terms of avionics, but there is a way in for them to get into the global supply chain in avionics and things like that through UAVs, because there's not a man in the loop. If it crashes, your autopilot hasn't killed anyone, so it's kind of interesting where that might lead. You know, when you think of like Sony. You know, Sony's brought out a drone, recently, that kind of stuff.
Did anyone, just digressing and talking about UAVs, did anyone see the story about the FAA and the fear that this Christmas there'll be 1 million drones under Christmas trees?
I saw that.
Well, I mean, there's been panics before. A few years ago, there was something called the very light jets. And again, there was predictions that the skies would be black with VLJs. You know, people would be flying these things left, right, and centre. The airline system would collapse. It didn't quite pan out like that.
Yeah, but you can go out and buy one of these things. Anything from £30 up to
But perhaps it's a kind of thing of education, and then maybe the novelty wearing off a little bit.
I wonder. I mean, I fear it's going to take an accident for people to to wake up to the possibilities.
Probably, that... yeah.
Yeah, I think so too. Well, on that note, let's get you across to the other side of the world, Tim. You then went across to the US and saw Airbus taking Boeing on in its backyard.
Yeah, well, they've landed on a beachhead. They have opened their fourth single-aisle factory in Mobile, Alabama. So that is going to be producing in 2016 the first US-built A321 is going to roll out of the Mobile factory. It's really a story of Airbus kind of going global from what it was, you know, its origins in perhaps what you could be, if you were uncharitable, say, is a, you know, European job creation scheme, to a global corporate entity, you know, a global corporate powerhouse, you know, factories in Toulouse, Hamburg, China, and now Alabama. And what was incredible to see there was the Americans and a European, you know, management. That's not, they're not going to get on there. There's going to be kind of, you know, some kind of friction or some kind of, you know, odd jokes about the French and the Germans being in charge. They absolutely, in Alabama, in Mobile, they absolutely love Airbus. It saved the city.
Yeah,
they love it so much. And the interesting thing is that why they love Airbus so much is that Boeing pushed them together because they were teamed up together for the tanker, the USAF tanker deal. Airbus didn't. Well, Airbus won that first, and then there's a recount, and then it was competed again, and then Boeing won it. But Boeing pushed Mobile and Airbus together so much. In this intense competition, that when Airbus were looking around, going, "Well, where can we go for a new FAL? It's going to have a deep water port."
Yeah,
it was pre-chosen. They'd already got that strong relationship, so that was fascinating as well.
Yeah, okay.
Interesting. Your visit was at the same time that the its competitor, the KC-46, actually flew for the first time.
That's right. Yeah, it's got in the air now, and they've got a lot of time to make up, you know, with that program.
Yeah, that one's rumbled on for a while. Let's come back to airline news then. On the BBC, Concorde fans hope to get jet airborne by 2019. Gareth, what do you think about that? We've been here before.
Thanks for coming to me. Listen, it's a fantastic story. It's a big headline, isn't it? It's a big headline grabber. Is it going to happen? In my humble opinion, it hasn't got a chance in hell of happening. It's a lovely idea, and I would love nothing more than to be proved entirely wrong, but I just can't see it.
There's talk of this group having £160 to £190 million to spend on this. I mean, I don't know where these stories are coming from, but there aren't many people around the world with that spare change in their pockets.
Well, and they won't have it for long either. I think. I can only wish them well, but it seems extraordinarily unlikely. Having had some exposure to the efforts of 558 to get and keep the Vulcan flying, the task ahead of any team hoping to fly Concorde just seems overwhelming.
Yeah, and I think as we said on a previous episode where we featured, in fact, Roland, I think you featured on that episode too.
I've been around a lot.
is the curse of death
that my third
to the sky?
I had bumped into somebody who'd worked at one of the maintenance facilities where Concorde was repaired. And they had very gently said to me that stuff had been done to the engines and so forth that makes them pretty much unusable. So, again, I don't know if that's scuttlebutt or not, but they've been sitting around for a long time now, not necessarily been that well cared for as well, some of them. So I really don't see how this is going to come off. However, I would love to see one again, and I would, you know, that
yeah. The
really
only
would...
the only sort of counter rumor to that, which I've sort of heard at some point, and I noticed when they were talking about where they were hoping to get their Concorde from, they were talking about a French one, was that French engineers had kept one of their Concordes in sort of perfect working order. With the idea, I suppose, that one day they would pull it out like a rabbit it from a hat and go, ha-ha, les Anglais. No, you've broken your engines and we're flying around in our Concorde. But again, it just seems too good to be true.
Yeah, sadly it does. Sadly it does. Okay, we'll leave the civilian news there then. We'll move on to some military stories. Before we get to Syria, let's just stay in the UK. The Sentinel set to continue another year, Tim, up until 2016. That's out in the Middle East, that platform at the moment, but it seems to go on forever. It was supposed to have been scrapped in the last defence review.
Well, I mean, it's a key ISTAR asset. Really, really in great use. There was a briefing we went to at DSEI recently where I think in the past decade, Five Squadron had not been on deployed ops, I think, for about 100 days, and that was when they went to red flag. So really, really hard worked, sort of Syria, but there's also been like, you know, kind of looking for those kidnapped schoolgirls in Nigeria. There was, I'm not sure whether they did some anti-flood ops, obviously Afghanistan. It's almost like the kind of cop that's always near retirement in kind of like 80s action films. It's always kind of getting near to its retirement. It gets a sort of a stay of execution. It's about to turn in its badge. And then the chief will say, you know, damn it, get back out on the streets. You know, we need you there. You know, yeah. This is your last case. So yeah. hopefully the powers will extend it on a little bit further as well and keep it going. You know, it is in great use, you know. Yeah. So shows how much it's needed. You know, if it was sitting around on the tarmac at Waddington and doing nothing, I think that would be a different story.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, the story there is the end of the Waddington Air Show, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's awful.
Very, very sad. I mean, you know, because of it, it's just become such an important base for ISTAR assets. And, you know, it seemed after that 2-year break that a return was unlikely. And funnily enough, the day after I'd had that conversation with ex commanding officer of 44 Squadron, 44 Rhodesia Squadron, Vulcan Squadron. It came to an end. So it's very sad that that's happened.
And breaking news as we record today, David Cenciotti, a good friend of the show, is reporting on the Syrian conflict that the Turks have been alerted and scrambled to deal with some Russian manufactured fighters. We hear talk of the Su-30, the Su-24 as well. Could these be Syrian or in fact Russian fighters?
I'm just reading that Russia's actually put its hands up, largely because NATO's now piled in sort of en masse and urged Russia to end its airstrikes in Syria. Russia apparently has said the violation was just for a few seconds and was due to poor weather. So it looks as if they've put their hands up and owned up. But God, what a messy situation this is, full stop.
Very risky as well, isn't it? All these scrambled to intercept and that sort of thing.
I mean, I think what's interesting from a sort of defence analyst's point of view is how far behind, still behind, kind of Russia is in the West in terms of precision weapons. You know, obviously you have some kind of footage of UAV footage of cluster bombs going down. You know, their ROEs are obviously a little bit kind of more looser than what the West's are, and perhaps one shouldn't judge when you have sort of terrible incidents like that hospital in Afghanistan. But sort of footage of what seems to be sort of SU-24s doing kind of Vietnam style.
It's almost carpet bombing, isn't it?
Dumb bombs from kind of medium altitude. It shows, you know, there are obviously some precision weapons being used, but you know, every NATO or coalition or Western coalition, or even you know with Arab countries like the UAE, it's all precision guided weapons now, and Russia is still lagging in that regard.
They're sort of tweeting to suggest the opposite. I gather the Russian defense ministry, but it seems a little unconvincing.
Okay, let's move on to some space news then. We've got a couple of stories to look at. Gareth, I want to come to you first. NASA has very generously opened up one of its archives, some absolutely fantastic photographs being released.
It's incredible. Well, they've actually given the images to Kip Teague, who some people might know about the Project Apollo archive. And according to Mr. Teague in the States, basically because NASA doesn't really have the resources to do anything with them themselves at the moment, I think they've given him 13,000 images in total, and I think about 8,500 have been uploaded to Flickr, and they're at 1800 DPI, so pretty high res as well, and they are absolutely incredible. There is a lot more to come if 8,500 isn't enough for you to be going on.
And there goes my hard drive.
But they're incredibly, revealing, and they fill in for me. Some people who listen will probably know this is a big sort of passion of mine. They fill in a lot of visual gaps, if that makes sense, because there are some great pictures out there, but of course now we've got a huge quantity of pictures in really, really high quality, and they are absolutely fascinating. If you want to lose a sort of a day or a week or a month, then we'll put the link on in the show notes. But they are, I don't know if any of you guys have looked at them, they're absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, they were.
I've seen a handful, certainly. As you suggested, they fill in a few gaps, and one of the things which I've become particularly aware of late, and I'll sort of mention it later, is just how familiar so many of the NASA images have become, and how hard it is to find those that are sort of a little bit more off the beaten track. And it's wonderful to see images that feel so fresh and unfamiliar.
Yeah, that's a good point.
An upsurge in people kind of claiming them with magnifying glass, claiming they found UFOs then.
Without
the shadows are wrong, or
evidence to support their cause. I must admit, I did catch myself looking at somebody holding on to an American flag, thinking that looks a little bit. the wind might have caught it.
Yeah, no, there's some great photos. We'll put a link to the show notes. And just aside, Gareth, just so you can pat yourself on the back, we've had some fantastic feedback about the space-related episodes we've been running. So it will be a subject we continue to keep in the show, I think.
Excellent.
A couple of other stories. Dave Homewood, Wings Over New Zealand, sent us a link to a New Zealand rocket company that's signing deals to fly to the moon, a story in the New Zealand Herald. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. It seems like everyone's getting in on the act. And an English company called Space LS, Roland, have also got into the launch business. They're looking to use their Prometheus 1 booster to launch CubeSats.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't been aware of it until you pointed it out to me the other day, and I thought I should have a quick look before coming on the show, just so that I wasn't completely caught cold. And what really intrigued me there was their explanation of the technology, suggesting that they are reverse engineering old British rocket engine designs,
and they're amazing.
And I mean, I immediately thought, God, it's the return of Black Arrow. And they're using ATP, high test peroxide and kerosene as fuel. So I mean, it's using the same fuels that the embryonic British space program was trying to use in the early 70s. So that was the thing that sort of excited me, was this idea that something that I thought had gone for good was enjoying some kind of rebirth, perhaps.
Yeah, and I noticed that one of their partners is also a partner on the Bloodhound SSC, which I think you got to see, didn't you, Roland?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to get along to the launch. I mean, in my with my sort of day job hat on, as a publisher at Penguin Books, we've done a deal with the Bloodhound team. We're going to be publishing a couple of their books alongside the project next year. And so I went along to the launch of the first car. I've seen it in bits before up at the Avonmouth Technology Center. This time around, they've got had it all together, sort of pulled the covers off, so sort of loud music, great video, and then an absolutely brilliant introduction to the car from Andy Green, who's the current land speed record holder, who's going to be driving it, and obviously is a RAF fast jet pilot as well. There was a huge sense of excitement in the room, what they have done is pretty remarkable. I mean, it you think the Vulcan drinks money, this thing is a whole lot more thirsty than that. But the idea of driving a car at 1,000 miles an hour at 0 feet altitude, which means a mile every 3.6 seconds under the power of a Typhoon jet engine and a hybrid rocket engine is pretty extraordinary. And there was a real sort of palpable sense of that, given that they actually had the hardware in the room. As an aside, actually, as Andy was talking about the car and talking about the power of that EJ2000 engine, he mentioned that he talked to the French air attaché the day before, and they'd been talking about the relative merits of Typhoon and Rafale, and he shared a confession from French air attaché that he could only admire the awesome power of the Typhoon, which I'm sure is the sort of thing he should never be caught saying in public.
I went the following day to the Bloodhound thing, and what was amazing, you know, apart from the sort of technical expertise and that's gone into it, is the sheer amount of people who came out to see it. You know, it was absolutely packed there, and they were having to let people in. I don't know, 200 people, 500 people at a time in to actually get in and see it, and that was the whole weekend.
No, I mean, incredible. They're really onto something, and I think the reason I was so interested in it from a publishing point of view is that it strikes me that when they're there at Hackskin Pan and doing the runs, it's going to capture people's imagination in much the same way that Felix Baumgartner's jump did. I mean, it's that kind of remarkable event with people gathered around their computer screens, if that's how they're going to choose to do it, willing them on. I mean, it's proper real-time excitement in a way that we didn't get last time around, because it was sort of it's pre-streaming, pre-internet. You had to wait for the 9 o'clock news, as it was then.
Yeah. Tim, one thing I forgot to ask you on your travels, you did manage to get back to London at one time in the last month or so. I'm very jealous you went to see the new exhibition at the Science Museum.
Cosmonauts.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, that is great. If you are anywhere near London between now and, I think, March, do go and see Cosmonauts at the Science Museum. It will blow your socks off. Really sort of rare stuff, the Soviets one-man lunar lander. It's an engineering model, of course, but I think it was only declassified in 1989. So seeing that there is like what could have been, fascinating stuff. Really, really, and all these things in this kind of context of sort of Russia or the Soviet Union kind of conquering space, and how it kind of tied in with the dreams of communism, or the communist kind of man and woman exploring the cosmos. Well worth going and seeing.
I can't wait to go and see that. Really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I'm going to get down there too. Well,
it does strike me that blow your socks off could be one of the cosmonauts' names as well.
That's bad.
Well, I tell you what, we'll take a little break now then, and when we come back, we'll talk to Roland about Into the Black.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
Oi, we know you're in there!
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Columbia on the nice ride, you're lofting a little bit, so you'll probably be slightly high at staging.
1 minute 45 seconds coming up on go, no go.
Columbia, you're negative seats.
That call up says Columbia, the altitude is too high for ejection seat use.
Mark. Columbia, you're go for SRB step.
Why did you feel the need to write this book? It sounds like a really bland question, but the shuttle's now gone. It's a long way down the road. I still haven't managed to see one of them being displayed, which is another one of my bucket list activities to do. But a lot's been written about the shuttle. Why go all the way back to the beginning to write about that very first launch?
I mean, there's two answers to that. One relates to something you've just said, and that is that lots has been written about the shuttle, and I'm not sure that. Actually, there has been that much written about the shuttle for a general readership. You know, there have been some great memoirs like Mike Mullane's memoir about flying the shuttle, riding rockets. And there have been some great reference books as well, and a really comprehensive two-volume history commissioned by NASA by Thomas Heppenheimer. But if you're looking for a piece of storytelling, if you're looking for a narrative that is built around the story of the shuttle, it's quite hard to find one. And that's not true of Mercury, where you have the right stuff. It's not true of Apollo, where there's any number of books to choose from Jim Lovell's book to Andrew Shakin's A Man on the Moon. There's plenty there. I felt that there was a need to write a book about a machine which I think has been sort of perhaps this has been countered point of its retirement, but been sort of slightly unfairly overlooked. I think much of its career was characterized either by a sort of almost bored familiarity of the fact that it was just go up and down, up and down, up and down, punctuated obviously on two terrible occasions by tragedy, and sort of either boredom or tragedy don't really do justice to a machine which was just an extraordinary piece of engineering. I mean, it was the highest flying, fastest flying winged vehicle ever produced, and not only that, it was the size of an airliner and could carry a payload 60 foot long and 15 foot wide into orbit. I mean, 40-50 tons this thing could carry. So I mean, it's just when you do see one sort of up close and personal in one of the US aviation museums, the first thing which strikes you is the size of it. I mean, it is enormous, and often they're displayed next to either an Apollo capsule or a Soyuz capsule, and the difference in size is just absolutely staggering, and you realize the magnitude of the task that those engineers set themselves in the early 70s. But in answer to the original question, which is why I did it, same reason as the other three books, which was that when I was 10 years old, the launch of the first shuttle captured my imagination. You know, I too young to see, watch and enjoy the moon missions. The last of the Apollo missions, the Apollo Soyuz test program, happened when I was 5 years old, and that passed me by too. So the shuttle was the first American space launch that had any meaning for me at all. And of course, that its meaning was greatly magnified by the fact that, you know, the butterfly on the bullet, as it's sometimes been described, was this winged flying machine. It was an aeroplane. It was something that conformed to the thing that I was most enthusiastic about, which was things with wings.
Why do you describe it as a hidden story? A lot of the write-ups talk about, and even the title, Into the Black, you know, it sort of hints and suggests that there was something untoward or hidden about its development.
I mean, yeah, there is a little bit. I mean, and again, this has sort of characterized some of the other books as well, which is that often if you see a paragraph mentioned in a sort of larger story, that paragraph is the thing that might be the source of most interest. And I'd seen very sort of sketchy references to the possibility that at some point during that first space shuttle mission, she'd been... The NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, had helped NASA and taken photographs during that mission using their spy satellites. And I thought that sounded interesting. I was having lunch with Richard Truly, who was on the reserve crew for the first mission was the pilot on the second mission. And I asked him about this, and I was sort of intrigued to get confirmation or not of whether or not American spy satellites taken pictures of Columbia during her first flight. Yeah. And he just started chuckling to himself, and he said, "You know, that's a really great story, and I can't tell you a thing about it." you know, now that's what I want to write about. And Dick, Richard Truly is important in this story, as was Bob Crippen, who's pilot on the first mission, in that they represent one half of the story that I'm trying to tell, which converges with the other half of the story on that first flight of Columbia, because Richard and Bob were both part of a program that ran throughout the 60s called Manned Orbiting Laboratory, which was a SAF space program running entirely in parallel to NASA's to try and build a manned military space station that was going to be used to spy on the Soviets, and they were building the hardware in 1969 when that program was cancelled. And it was cancelled because Nixon had to make a decision between that and the big KH-9 hexagon CIA spy satellite. And he was able to make that decision in favor of the unmanned system because a little way down the line, there was the promise of digital spy satellites, which would be able to beam their imagery back from space without the need for these bucket drops over the Pacific being picked up by the Air Force and flown back to be developed in Rochester, New York State. So, I mean, that was a long process. The digital satellites promised real-time intelligence, which was a crucial promise. And so as a result of the promise of that real-time intelligence, these astronauts who'd been training to fly this MOL, Manned Orbiting Laboratory space station, were all out of a job. The youngest seven of them were taken on by NASA, and both Richard Truly and Bob Crippen were in that number. And that group of seven astronauts, as some of the Apollo astronauts retired from the astronaut office, became central to the developing space shuttle program. They joined the NASA astronauts office in 1969, and the shuttle was approved finally in 1972, and then the rest of the decade was spent developing it. And these were the guys who ended up being absolutely instrumental to the development of the avionics, development of the fly-by-wire system, development of the computer displays, and also the cockpit ergonomics and things as well. They were also the ones who certainly two of them who flew Enterprise off the back of 747 in over Edwards Air Force Base in 1976. Bob Crippen was on the first crew, Richard Truly on the second, and they were on board the first eight shuttle missions. So it's the story in a way of two things: the development of the shuttle and the American spy satellite program, and how actually the hidden story, which I hope I'm sort of bringing to life, is the race against time during that first mission, when it was known that some tiles were missing from the heat shield as a result of acoustic shock on the launch that hadn't been properly computed and estimated. They knew that there were some tiles missing. What they didn't know is whether or not that acoustic shock might have led to tiles missing from a more crucial part of the heat shield. And NASA had no way of checking.
Yeah.
And so they asked the NRO. And the NRO had one satellite, one KH-11 satellite in the sky, which had any possibility of taking pictures of the shuttle. It was on a polar orbit while the shuttle was on an equatorial orbit. And so they first had to discover whether or not those, the two spacecraft would be over part of the globe at exactly the same time. And there were, in a 72-hour mission, there were three one-and-a-half-minute windows. And they were having to do something that they had not really tried before to try and reassure NASA that Columbia would be able to come home, and that the astronaut on board, who'd been put out of a job by the promise of these spy satellites, might be able to return home safely. So, wow. I mean, I've absolutely loved getting to grips with it all. Yeah. It was a bigger, tougher job than the other books for a combination of reasons. I'm pleased now with the results, and I've been really hugely encouraged by the reactions, first of all of Bob Crippen and Dick Truly, who read it, and Dick's been kind enough to write a foreword for the book, which is just a tremendously encouraging endorsement, and then by the reactions of a handful of the people I've sent it to.
Put it into context, they're quite special people. I mean, people like Chris Hadfield, Winkle Brown have been very, very complimentary, haven't they?
Well, they have. I mean, you know, it's I've got to say, I've been sort of walking on air since hearing back from them. I mean, the Chris Hadfield thing, I'm going to say it made my day, it made my week. I was glad I was sitting down when I opened the email. He just said that, he'd been emailing me with the odd editorial note, often typos that he picked up in the proofs. I was thinking, this is insane. I'm getting my space shuttle book edited by Chris Hadfield. At the end of it, he was very kind. He said he thought it was well written, well researched, and that he thought it told the shuttle story better than any other book had previously. And when Chris Hadfield, who had no obligation to say anything nice about it at all, said that, I mean, it made me feel more confident about what I was putting out there.
Mark, 4:08. Columbia, stand by for negative return. Mark, negative return. And your revamp is good. Mark, 4:25.5 seconds. With that call up from Capcom, Brandon Stein, Columbia now committed to space travel. Young and Crippen can no longer turn around and return to the launch site.
Stop me when it gets tedious. But I mean, the process was interesting and different this time around, in that with the previous three books, which were obviously about British military history subjects, I was talking to people who by and large had felt they'd done something noteworthy, which never properly had the kind of recognition they felt that perhaps it should have. And at the same time, there wasn't that much archival documentary material to sift through. So I was very, very reliant on the interviews, testimonies of people I was speaking to, all of whom were very eager to talk to me, and had less some documentary material to go through. The opposite was true with this. You know, the astronauts have all been interviewed to death. So sort of trying to get anything fresh out of conversations with them is quite tricky. And at the same time, you know, NASA's predisposition as a civilian organization is to release all the information. So it was incredibly easy and often worryingly tempting as well to really disappear down a rabbit hole on any particular subject, whether it's the thermal properties of the, you know, the heat shield tiles, or the nature of the aerodynamics of the Delta wing, or the rocket engines that were designed. You could always go further and further and further into it. And, you know, while that might be interesting as a sort of academic exercise, it doesn't make for a great read if you then just regurgitate it all.
Columbia, Houston, your go at 5:30. Me go, 8+3, 4.
Mark, 5 minutes, 40 seconds. That call up from Capcom, Brandon Stein, says that Columbia's trajectory, navigation, and engine performance look good.
Columbia, reading you loud and clear.
Given a go to stay on orbit and
Columbia,
get
Houston,
out of the suits.
You guys did so good, we're going to let you stay up there for a couple days. Your go for on orbit.
Spacecraft, let go for on orbit. This thing is just performing just outstanding.
Ronan, the question for you, because of the wealth of material that you've referred to about, you know, what came before, if you like, from Mercury onwards, If like me, you've kind of embraced a lot of this written material and ploughed through it, you feel like you know some of these personalities quite well. And John Young is obviously a name that comes up all the way through. Mm. Clearly a very complex character. I'm picking my words a bit carefully, and you probably know why, because of maybe some of what was written about John Young. Do you feel...
The only time the only book in which I've come across John Young presented as particularly peculiar is actually Andrew Smith's book Moondust, which is if anyone hasn't read it, I couldn't recommend it more highly. I mean, it certainly rekindled my interest in space. And he goes to meet the remaining surviving moonwalkers. He met John Young, who said sort of struggled to sort of make eye contact with him, sort of often looked at the table or looked at his shoes while he was talking. And you know, that was when I started this book, the abiding impression I had of John Young. As I've done the work on the book, and as I've learned more and more about him, as I have spoken to people who know him well, and I've watched endless hours of video of John Young as well, I've liked him more and more and more. He's got an incredible sense of humor, incredibly self-deprecating, super, super smart, and described alongside Hoot Gibson as the best pilot whoever went through the astronaut's office. And, you know, perhaps wow, he was. I've got endless amounts of time for John Young. I just think he's a remarkable character. And I hope that he, if anyone emerges as the hero of this book, it's John Young. Certainly that's something I would very much like people to take away from it. I think he's been something of an unsung hero, of the American space program, outside those who have made it their business to become aficionados of it. But I, in all of the time I spent working on the book, I didn't hear a bad word about it. In fact, just the opposite.
That's brilliant to hear. Andrew's been a guest on this show, as has Mike Mullane, incredibly.
Yeah, actually, I'd forgotten about it now. Mike certainly wasn't overly enthusiastic about the John Young, George Abbey axis, yeah, and I mean, the way in which flights were chosen.
was Mike's boss, wasn't he? Essentially,
yeah.
And perhaps John Young's qualities as a manager shouldn't take anything away from his qualities as an astronaut. Those two things are very different. But he's an incredible personal story, isn't it? What he's achieved in terms of space travel, for want of a better phrase, is absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, there's been no one quite like him. I mean, he flew the first manned Gemini mission with Gus Grissom. He flew the first orbital rendezvous in Gemini 10 with Mike Collins. He flew on Apollo 10 as command module pilot around the moon, then went back to the moon as commander of Apollo 16, where he was a moonwalker alongside Charlie Duke, and famously obviously got the farts from the Orange Duke and forgot he was on a hot mic. And actually he was on the moon when Congress approved funding for the shuttle. So he was on the moon when news of that was passed up from Houston, and he said, this country needs that shuttle. You'll see. And he then went on to become chief of the astronaut office, where he oversaw the Apollo Soyuz test project. Flew the first shuttle mission, flew the first shuttle mission to carry the European Space Lab laboratory, and I think had penciled himself in to fly Hubble before the loss of Challenger disrupted the whole shuttle program in 1986. And he didn't fly again after that Skylab flight, Spacelab flight, rather.
Just to pull you back quickly onto sort of spy satellites and the shuttle rolling, but there is a British connection, isn't there? And that wasn't there a mission specialist going to be a British astronaut as a mission specialist for the Zircon?
Yeah, well, this is what I've got onto next. I'm glad you asked about that. Peripheral project as a sort of companion piece, I suppose, to the shuttle book, which is written. I've just been working on the photo sections over the last couple of days, just choosing the pictures and doing the captions. So I'm looking at what I'm going to write next, and as a kind of companion piece to the story of the first flight of the space shuttle, I've been getting really interested in something I've been calling to myself In Search of the Real Dan Dare, and a sort of account of Britain's very patchy relationship with manned spaceflight, which I suppose perhaps certainly in my mind begins with Eric Winkle Brown flying the Messerschmitt 163 Comet at the end of the Second World War, becoming the first Allied pilot ever to fly a rocket plane. You know, Eric knew well characters like Chuck Yeager and Scott Crossfield, you know, the early rocket plane pilots. He was there throughout that period. He had the opportunity to fly the X-15 himself, but wasn't prepared to become an American citizen to do so. There was a contemporary of Eric's, Jeffrey Higgs, who flew Chase on one of the X-15 space flights. And then there was a team from BAC who, in the late 60s, early 70s, were embedded at North American Rockwell, doing design work on the shuttle. And I made contact with some of the veterans of that, who all came out of work at Filton on Concorde. So that was their particular expertise. and then as you getting back to where we started with your question, in 1984, there were four British astronauts chosen, civil servant, a naval satellite communications expert, a British Army signals colonel, and Wing Commander Nigel Wood, who was a test pilot and had spent time at Edwards, and was actually at Edwards when the first space shuttle landed. He was there working on the fly-off between the F-15 and F-16 XL,
to decide what was going to become America's F-111 replacement. So he was on the F-15 team, as was an integral part of that. Ex-Lightning pilot, and he'd flown on QRA up and down the German border on 93 Squadron Lightning. So, I mean, I could go on and on and on about this, but I've spent four or five hours.
Your encyclopedic knowledge is slightly overwhelming.
It's very, very sort of fresh in my mind, this, because it's the next big exciting thing that I'm working on. So, you know, I've interviewed Nigel at length about his time on the shuttle program, and it's been absolutely riveting. And then as a sort of coder to all of this, I'm in a month's time from now flying out to Mojave, where I'm going to be talking to Dave Mackay, the Virgin chief test pilot, Virgin Galactic chief test pilot, who some of your listeners will be aware is a Brit. He's a Scot. He's ex Boscombe Down fixed wing test squadron test pilot, RAF Harrier pilot prior to that. And so that's sort of in my mind, and I don't discount Tim Peake from this story at all, but with the idea of Dave Mackay firing the rocket on a winged space plane, I think we may have found our Dan Dare at that point.
Okay, John, we copied the shortest of all burn reports. And, Krip, we understand you have two of three APUs running now.
Yeah, you're fighting out there a little bit, but you understood correct.
Rog, thank you.
This is Mission Control. That is nominal at this time to have two of the three APUs running. The third APU is powered up at entry interface minus 5 minutes. We're now at entry interface minus 19 minutes, 22 seconds.
Roland, let me then bring you back to Into the Black, published sadly, because it's very exciting, not until March next year. Before we move on, though, is there a tidbit you can just leave us with, one of those fantastic facts that you found out that you never knew before you started writing the book?
Funny enough, I think that the story which most, or the little factoid that most surprised me, was that, and this only speaks again to the close relationship between the UK and US when it comes to test flying, was that Deke Slayton, who was one of the original Mercury 7 astronauts, who was grounded until Apollo Soyuz because of a heart arrhythmia, but was absolutely, you know, one of those guys that Tom Wolfe wrote about so brilliantly in The Right Stuff. He flew over to the UK to help do some of the supersonic testing on the English Electric P1, which was the precursor, obviously, to the Lightning. And I read in his autobiography, the brilliantly titled Deke! Exclamation mark, that the plane that he most enjoyed flying through a long career in test flying was the English Electric P1.
Wow. Ah. Okay. Well, there you go. Well, Roland,
it's official.
Well, it is now, yeah. Roland, we can order the book. We can pre-order the book on Amazon, I believe. Anywhere
absolutely.
Else?
Yeah, I think it's up and it's ready to.
I already have. I confess.
Have you? Thank you. Yes, I saw that done. The one had been pre-ordered. I don't know who it is.
I've just added it to my wish list. Hopefully, the Christmas list will be seen by her who should be obeyed. And you can, of course, do that through the Amazon link on our website. Please do that. That'd help all of us out, put a little bit in the pot for us. Just before we move off then, Roland, anything you want to wrap up with?
No, I mean, I think you've indulged me more than enough. I've yacked and yacked and yacked, and the opportunity to do that, because I don't get to do it very often. I'm very, very grateful. Thank you.
No, we're definitely having you back, and we've still got the meetup as well to organise, so we're going to do that. But we're going to take a quick break now, and after the break, we're going to come over to Tim for his latest X10 Top 10.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups, which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the Society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Crew now incorporating tactical air navigation system data into the spacecraft. Mach 7. 135,000 feet, range 221 miles.
Columbia, dead control on the ground looks track. Very quiet to us.
Looks quiet in here, too. What a way to come to California.
Columbia, you're out of 130K now on the tracking, 6.4 Mach, looking good.
Roger that.
Okay, Tim, over to you. X10, our top 10.
Okay, and this episode's X10 top 10. It's quite topical here. So recently, the Airbus Perlin 2 stratospheric glider has made its first test flight as part of an attempt to soar to 90,000 feet next year. So, with that in mind, let's take a look at the top 10 gliding feats. At number 10, Captain Eric Moody. In 1982, a British Airways 747 flying near Jakarta, Indonesia, experienced a quadruple engine flameout when it flew from a volcanic ash cloud. Captain Eric Moody coolly told passengers, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking. We have a small problem. All four engines have stopped." But the crew glided the stricken jumbo for almost 15 minutes before successfully restarting the engines. Phew. And number 9, the Cayley glider. Possibly the first ever aeronautical engineer, Britain's Sir George Cayley was the first to identify the four forces of flight. In 1853, he persuaded his footman to put his fringe to the test by firing a full-scale glider across Brompton Dale, North Yorkshire. Replicas of the glider flown in 1973 and later in 2003 proved his glider design was sound. And number 8, the rescue of Mussolini. Germany had begun the war in the West with airborne and glider-borne troops, so it's perhaps no surprise that gliders were used to pull off one of the most daring raids in World War II, when commandos rescued captured Italian dictator Mussolini from a ski resort in the mountains using assault gliders. Where eagles dare indeed. And number 7, going the distance. What is the longest ever glider flight, do you reckon? 100 miles? 200? 500? Try a record staggering 3,008 kilometres flight made in 2003 by Claus Oman and Carl Rabada in a Nimbus 4 over Eastern Andes. Flight lasted 15 hours and 8 minutes. And number 6, Otto Lilienthal, the father of gliding and indeed heavier than air flight. He studied birds and how they flew to unlock the secrets of flight. Making over 2,000 flights, his gliding experience formed the basis for much of the Wright brothers' work. The rest, as they say, is history. And number 5, the Perlin 1 project. In 2006, late Steve Fawcett and N.R. Endervodsson took a modified DG500 glider to 50,720 feet by using high-altitude mountain waves to surf into the stratosphere. They were wearing pressure suits for this record-breaking glider flight, which was particularly difficult in the confined cockpit of a glider. The Perlin 2 project aims to soar even higher to 90,000 feet in 2016, higher than an SR-71 flies. And number 4, the Space Shuttle. The gliders are usually graceful, elegant designs, but the Space Shuttle had the aerodynamic qualities of a brick outhouse. While high-performance gliders have a lift-and-drag rate of 70, the orbiter is about 1. With no chance of going around, astronauts had to get the orbiter on the ground first time. No pressure then. Fun fact, NASA uses a specially modified Gulfstream BizJet to train astronauts in the correct approach and landing skills to land the world's heaviest and draggiest glider. And number 3, the Azores glider. In 2001, an Air Transat A330, flying from Toronto, Canada to Lisbon, Portugal, ran out of fuel due to a fuel leak in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. With both engines flamed out 65 miles away from land, the crew managed to glide the aircraft to a safe landing in the Azores, saving 306 lives on board. And number 2, airborne for 56 hours. In 1952, pilot Charles Agter set a solo endurance record of 56 hours and 15 minutes in the Arsenal Air 100 glider over France. Incredibly, the record still stands today as the FAI banned further attempts after another pilot died trying to beat it. Too dangerous. And number one, what is the most amazing glider feat? Pegasus Bridge. Landing on a glider in a specific field next to a massive obstacle like a bridge at night with no GPS or night vision goggles while people are shooting at you. Perhaps one of the most underrated feats of airmanship in the entire course of World War II was in June 1944, six Horsa gliders flown by the Glider Pride Regiment pilots landed to capture a critical bridge over the River Orne on the morning of D-Day. The closest glider landed at a staggering 47 yards from the target, allowing the Oxen Bucks infantry to surprise the Germans and capture this vital bridge. Is this the ultimate gliding feat? And that's a wrap.
Wow.
Yeah.
Any other gliding feats?
A handful. First of all, the connection between your number one feat and the space shuttle, in that all of the crews who flew the space shuttle into Edwards off back of 747. That's there's Joe Engel and Dick Truly was one of them. Fred Hayes of Apollo 13 fame and Gordon Fullerton was the other. They were all made honorary members of the World War II Glider Pilots Association as a result
wow.
of that
didn't feat, know that.
Which I think was a lovely connection between two of those on your top 10. The Gimli glider is a favorite of mine, which was the Air Canada.
That's right, yeah.
Glider, which landed in the middle of I think a sort of a car boot sale after it ran out of fuel and was brought safely down to earth on dead stick.
There's an interesting thing. I mean, I went with the Azores glider for that.
Yeah, because it's a slightly trickier target in the middle of the Atlantic. The one other one which I love, just because it's very very Russian. Was that in 1954, the Soviets landed four Yak-14 gliders on the Arctic ice to deliver a bulldozer to their North Pole ice station. You couldn't do that. It's too far for helicopters or certainly helicopters in 1950s. So they towed gliders, much like the sort of Pegasus Bridge, newer versions of Pegasus Bridge gliders out there, but with a bulldozer on board, which I guess has long since sunk through the ice to the bottom of the Arctic Sea.
Well, if you've got a great gliding story or an incident you want to tell us about, drop us a line, tweet us, or put a note on our Facebook page. Well done, Tim. Great top 10.
Fantastic.
Thanks.
Brilliant.
This is Max Flight. I love aviation podcasts. That's why I do Airplane Geeks, the UAV Digest, and the PaxX podcast. But when I need a break from creating my own shows, I turn to Extended. Peter, Tim, and Gareth do a stellar job and bring us all interesting and informative episodes. Extended, a great aerospace program.
Everything looks real good. 5,290.
2,500 feet.
You're coming. You're down. 50 feet. 40. 30. 20. 10. 5. 4. 3. 2. 1. Down. Those gears, 10 feet.
5, 4, 3, touchdown. Talk about Skipper.
Houston, Columbia, no Marola.
Welcome home, Columbia. Beautiful, beautiful.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And so to the get involved and feedback section of the show. First, Kieran Murphy writes to us from Ireland. He said in our last show we mentioned two UK accidents with one fatality. We also had a very sad fatality here in Ireland when Howard Cox, a well-known pilot of the BD5, suffered a fatal engine fire and forced landing on his way to Foynes Air Show. It was one of only two BD5s flying in Europe, with the other belonging to Red Bull, I believe. Howard is a great loss to the Irish aviation scene. Thanks very much for that, Kieran. I didn't know about that. Anyone else hear that story?
No, yes, I hadn't. That's very sad.
I had done it. Very sad indeed.
Yeah, it is. Very sad. Thanks very much for sharing that with us, Kieran, and our thoughts to everyone involved with Howard Cox. Okay, Max Flight from the Airplane Geeks wrote to us, says, many, many years ago, I was involved in a project associated with the Space Shuttle program, and that was called the Advanced Solid Rocket Motor. Now, for some of you, you may know that Max used to work for Pratt & Whitney. I'll go on. He writes, as a result, I got to meet real rocket scientists. Many of them are not at all like the rest of us, which was a rather refreshing side benefit to working with them. The most fun story was one of them had a pea-sized piece of propellant from the Shuttle solid rocket booster. What do you do with that? Well, you try to ignite it in the parking lot, of course. I'll just say it's not easy, but it can be done with spectacular results. Anyway, the purpose of this is to respond to the conversation in episode 46 about what personality type is best suited to very long-term space travel. It turns out that one of the scientists, not the one with the pyrotechnic tendencies, had done a complete study of just that question. Her study concluded that the type of person that would most ensure success for missions lasting years was, and wait for it, convicts. That's right, incarcerated criminals. I guess that makes sense. It might also explain why Australia turned out so well. Max, I'll leave that to you to explain to our Australian cousins. Just finishes up with, I'd provide a citation if I had it, but this was a long time ago and there might have been some beers involved as well. I love rocket scientists. Thanks very much for that, Max. I would love to have seen what that pea-sized piece of propellant from the Shuttle solid rocket booster went off like in the car park.
That would have been fantastic.
Yeah, I must ask him if there's any photos. I must go back. Okay, moving on. Errol Cavett writes to us, good day, Extended. Well done on consistently putting out very good shows. I think the Battle of Britain top 10 were good choices, but sadly, I knew them. You clever old so-and-so, Errol. He goes on to write, I'm fortunate that this level of avgeekiness has been useful for something. Back in 1982, the Auckland Area Sea Scouts had a Battle of Britain contest, which I won after a three-way tie-break Q&A session. My prize was to be in the backseat of a Harvard, and it's ZKWAR, which was flown by legendary New Zealand Warbirds founding president Trevor Bland, and he got to fly that for the Battle of Britain flypast of Sir Keith Park Memorial Airfield on the 14th of September that year. Wow. He's put some photos. Yeah, what a fantastic prize. So well done. Your avgeekiness paid off. He also sent us another note just to follow up on that and say, sadly, Trevor Bland recently passed away in December last year and that aircraft was present for the funeral at Ardmore Airfield, and it was now painted in white US Navy colours. And he put another photo in the link there. So we'll put those in the show notes. Well done, Errol, and thanks for those photos.
Most of you standing out here in front of me have done what John and I have been doing for about the past 9 years. We've been busting our buns to get the space shuttle up. Well, let me tell you, it was well worth the effort. We've got one fantastic machine, and we have given the country one marvelous technological capability. For me personally, it was the darndest time I've ever had in my entire life.
On to promoting aerospace. We were asked to give out the results of the school's Aerospace Challenge 2015. That was, of course, to design a heavy lift airship. And the winners were Latimer Upper School from London with their Nimbus airship. Joint runners-up were the 2524 Oakington Squadron Air Training Corps from Cambridgeshire with Oakington Massive. And also joint runners-up were St Paul's School in London with Levitate. So well done to everybody there. I think that's something the Royal Aeronautical Society support, Tim. So, yeah. But it's a great project.
Well done, guys.
Yeah, well done. Neil Braden, he's asked us to give a mention to the 48-hour sim challenge. This is one pilot and his support team who fly for 48 hours without sleep in a fixed-base 737 NG simulator. They are raising money for three great charities, I think health charity and a couple of air ambulances. So fantastic work. Now, that is on January the 11th, 2016. We'll put links to that in the show notes. You can follow them. The event will be streamed live on the gaming website Twitch. So well done, Neil. Good luck with that. And then just finally from me on shout outs, great guest of the show, Tracy Curtis Taylor, left these shores a few days ago for her 13,000 mile journey across Europe, the Mediterranean, the Arabian Desert, and all the way through to Australia. The flight is expected to take 12 to 14 weeks, and she should be in Sydney in early 2016. Tracy's flight is in honour of Amy Johnson, of course, and her epic solo flight to Australia in 1930. So although she's no longer here, good luck, Tracy, and we'll follow you all the way down. So, Tim, any shout-outs?
Yeah, I think I've got a shout-out for, obviously, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your point of view, in London. It's at RSHQ, but it's our autumn careers fair, Careers in Aerospace, live on the 6th of November. So if you know anybody, any young people, any older people even, who are interested in careers in aerospace, that is the place to be on 6th of November. Get in, book your place early. It's always highly popular. There's always kind of crowds and stuff, but you get kind of free advice. There's recruiters there. There's services. There's people like formerly Gapan. The name escapes me now, what they are now. Lots and lots of advice, useful advice and recruitment people there. So, you know, to get a career in aviation, aerospace, or even perhaps even space.
Tim, we've recently been helping out some people who have come to us for advice and a bit of direction. Not that I can help them with that, but we can certainly network them on. Something that keeps getting lost is the Royal Aeronautical Society also provides free career advice as well to anyone. You don't have to be a member to participate in that service, do you?
That's right. Yeah, we've got a dedicated careers and education department. They've seen every problem under the sun or every issue under the sun. They're well plugged into the industry. It's always worth giving them a ring, dropping them an email, coming around and setting up an appointment. You don't have to be a member, and seeing, you know, what advice they can give you.
Excellent stuff. Okay, Gareth.
Yeah, it's a little bit different from me. I just wanted to give a little shout out to The Martian, which a few people may have surely seen. It's just come out at the cinema. It's just launched last week when I was on holiday, so I haven't yet got to see it. But the reviews are very good. And I have to say, though, the book I really, really enjoyed. It's written by a guy called Andy Weir, whose dad was a particle scientist. It's a work of fiction, but it's I personally think that anybody who's got an interest in aerospace and space will enjoy it. There's lots of science in there. It's absolutely fascinating. It's also quite amusing, as well as a bit of a thriller. He manages to kind of meld all of these things together, and it appears as if it's been translated very well in a Ridley Scott directed film. Fortunately, his first good one in ages. And although I do really like Ridley Scott, most of his recent films haven't been very good, in my opinion. So I'm really looking forward to seeing it. But it is an absolutely brilliant book. I really, really enjoyed it and would highly recommend it.
I'm halfway through the book, so
it's fantastic. I'm a huge
The butler did it.
It's brilliant.
I can't wait to go to bed so I can read another few chapters. Exactly, it's really exactly gripping.
The old couldn't put it down cliche. Yeah. Was just I think I read it in a matter of days. It was brilliant.
Yeah, fantastic. Roland, apart from Into the Black, is there anything else you want to give a shout out to?
Yeah, another book, actually, which is a new history of the first couple of wars of second first couple of years of the Second World War by an author called James Holland. It's called The War in the West, Volume 1, Germany Ascendant, 1939-1941. But it is just the best, most readable account of those early years of World War II that I've read for a really long time. And from an AvGeek perspective, it was absolutely riveting. The real sort of premise of the book is to sort of put to the sword slightly the sort of received wisdom that sort of plucky little Britain facing incredibly technologically advanced, almost overwhelming enemy in Germany, and replacing it with a sort of new perspective about the relative power, sophistication, and organisation of those two antagonists. And actually it's something that rather than I sort of worried that I was going to sort of miss this idea that it was sort of plucky little Britain against the odds. And actually it was sort of replaced by a view of the situation that it is rather more impressive with respect to Britain, and certainly made me feel as proud as I ever had of what was achieved in those early years. It reads like a thriller, brilliant sort of character studies, and it's hugely enjoyable and thought-provoking. And despite it being a big, substantial history book, I would imagine that once people have started it, they'll hoover it up in days. I certainly did.
Sounds really interesting. I was just trying to look it up. I'll put a link to it in the show notes for anyone who's interested in having a look at that, The War in the West by James Holland, you said, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, James might be familiar to people most recently, actually, as one of the commentators and experts doing Channel 4's coverage of the Battle of Britain 75th anniversary flypast. So he's written a book on the Dam Busters and on the Battle of Britain. And this is a sort of slightly broader history, which places certainly all the sort of aviation developments in context. Very, very good.
Excellent stuff. Okay, I think that's just about all we have time for then. We would like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions, and to NASA and ESA for some of the inserts in the show. You can find Extended now on Stitcher.com, UKpodcast.com, poddirectory.com, and of course iTunes. If you are a new listener, please leave us some feedback. If it's on iTunes or one of the other directories, please leave us some feedback there. It helps to keep us up in the charts. We've dropped down a little bit again recently, so people are finding it a bit difficult to find us. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license. Roland, thank you very much again for coming back onto the program. Cannot wait for Into the Black.
No, it's an absolute pleasure, as ever. Thank you so much for having me and listening to all the tosh that I spout.
No, we've...
That's the fifth headphones marking on the car.
Yeah, I think it's four now, maybe five next time. But yeah,
get the paint shop on the case tomorrow.
Yeah, definitely.
Roland, where can we find out about you online?
I've got a website which is not updated as often as it should be, which is just Roland with a W, rolandwhite.com. The best place probably is to follow me on Twitter, which is simply at Roland White. And I'm on Twitter very regularly, posting sort of pictures and observations and keeping people up to date with developments on the book. So that's if you want the freshest news of what I'm up to, follow me on Twitter.
Okay. Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, I'm at RESTimR on Twitter. And you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society site at www.aerosociety.com.
And Gareth, how about you?
Yeah, Gareth_Stringer on Twitter, and everything GAR related is at globalaviationresource.com.
Okay, you can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk, as well as Facebook, XTP Media. Okay, that's it, folks. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Roland White.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, all. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from Gareth Stringer.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
To do a hangout, so
what, a Google hangout.
Yeah, so
can we not just do that in the pub, or
it's what all the kids are doing.
Are you painting headphones on the side of your car?
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, I've got a line of four now. I just need the one more. Sorry, I can edit that out, I reckon.
Sorry.
I don't know if I can. I might have to leave it in. It's too good.
No, leave it in. It's probably my best gag of the year.
Blow your socks off. Yeah, he was on Mir in 1988.
Right.
Listening to all the tosh that I spout.
It's going to be emotional, isn't it?
Yeah, Dad, whatever. I've yacked and yacked and yacked. And famously, obviously, got the farts from the orange juice. And go, ha-ha, les Anglais.
And that's a wrap.
Wow.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.